Welcome to the Empowered Whistleblower Podcast. Are you one of many Americans who are tired of people being bullied and discriminated? You are not alone. Bullying has a rippling effect on the person who is being harassed and everyone associated with the bullied person. The targeted adult or child may have been physically or psychologically bullied. They often bring home their anguish with them, and this can have a crippling effect on everyone associated with the one who's being bullied or discriminated. It's time to shed some light on how to reduce bullying in the school systems, how to create safe and healthy work environments for employees. I blow the whistle on how to protect yourself if you're being bullied and educate listeners on their rights if they're being bullied or discriminated. I bring in the best experts who provide empowering strategies, tips on resiliency, how to handle the experience of being bullied or discriminated, how to heal and overcome the effects of being mistreated. If you are ready to gain knowledge and insights on bullying and discrimination, you are in the right place. Welcome to the Empowered Whistleblower Podcast. Hey, welcome. I'm Dawn Westmoreland of the Empowered Whistleblower Podcast. Today, I have Dr. John Huber, and he has a podcast called Mainstream Mental Health, and he has been a clinical scientist, or I say scientist, psychologist for over 20 years. What's so cool about this is he is a peer podcaster on Mental Health News Radio. He's been out there helping people with clinical issues, with mental health issues. And he's also been a stand-up comedian, which is hard to believe. So welcome, Dr. John Huber. Welcome, welcome.
Thank you, Don. I appreciate the opportunity to come on your show. We've talked so many times, and now it's going down in history.
It is. Okay, so there's some very important things we're going to talk about. We're going to get deep, but we're also going to get funny because we're all about balance. What is a clinical forensic psychologist?
Okay, first and foremost, I'm a clinical psychologist by trade. That means I've been trained to work with some of the most severe cases in mental health as far as diagnoses and identifying. And now within that, it's a very broad spectrum. And I've been exposed to many, many different things from what we used to call multi-personality disorder. Now it's dissociative identity disorder, to schizophrenia, to general depression, bipolar disorder, autism, all these different types of diagnoses. And I've worked in state mental health facilities and, you know, kind of the last resort when all the other placements didn't work for the individual. So I've had some pretty extreme cases, and that's kind of what clinical psychologists are trained to work with. Now, they don't all choose to work with those populations, but they've had the training, and their licensure reflects that. Now, that's compared to, for example, a counseling psychologist who has the skills that if they really needed to, they could work with those other populations, but they haven't had the specific training with those extreme levels. They've done a lot more training with what you would generally see in a normal psychology practice, for example, marital issues, depression, day-to-day living, thriving, coping skills and types of things, which clinical psychologists also get trained in. They just take it to that next level. That's the basic core training. And then you can specialize. You know, there's a lot of people out there, for example, who may be geriatric specialists or child specialists within clinical or counseling, or even school psychology. There's some, you know, autism specialists and things like that. And having started my career as a school psychologist, I had training with children. I'd worked with families and how to interact with their kids. And in that trek, that chapter of my life, I had to get proficient with a lot of legal issues for special education and, believe it or not, child abuse and types, that type of thing, ethics and HIPAA rules. And so all of a sudden I'm like very interested in what goes on in the court process. So I got specialized training in my clinical education in forensic psychology, and the basic level of that is, you know, how to do things like competency to stand trial. You have an understanding of things like the insanity plea. And then it just kind of expanded, got training and worked with individuals who are, you know, competent in dealing with child custody issues and divorces. And that was something I originally thought, oh, I want to do a lot of that because I want to help all these kids. Mm-hmm. What I found out was that it's extremely stressful. It's extremely traumatic. If the divorce is so dynamic and so contested that you need to call in a psychologist in this kind of situation, it's not a nice, pleasant event. So I found out I don't like to work more than one or two of those cases in any year because it becomes very overwhelming for me. And I start, you know, worrying about these kids that are being used most often as some kind of pawn to harm one or both of the parents.
Yeah, so, I can imagine. I mean, because I know you have children yourself, so I could see your love of helping children.
Well, and, you know, I started helping kids long before I had my children, and I think I'm glad that I did that too, because some of the child abuse cases and things like that that I ran into when I first started out were so bad and, you know, still stick in my head that if I'd already had children at that point, you know, I may not be on the phone right now because my gut instinct was just to climb over the table and pound this person in front of me because yeah. of how heinous the crime was they did with the children. And that was without having kids. If I had already raised or been raising my daughter and my son at that point, it would have been a lot harder. Now I've learned to cope. And as much as I still think, oh man, that guy just needs pummeled, you know, you don't do that, you know, and that's one of the problems with forensic psychology for the practitioner is that we don't always get to do or talk about what we want to have happen. We have to talk about what the data shows and what the numbers actually say need to have happen. So oftentimes, you know, we don't get to do the nice political correct move and say, oh, well, this is what we should. No, the numbers say this is what needs to happen and this person needs to move forward. For example, in some states, when it comes down to releasing people who've been convicted of, say, being a child molester, and they've done their 10, 15, 20 years, the states, for example, like Florida, have rules that you have to be assessed for potential to commit your crime again. And once we look at the actuarial data on that, and if they meet the appropriate criteria, they have to be signed off on by a psychologist or psychiatrist, and you get two out of three who agree, then you can be released into the general population, knowing that, you know, there's no guarantee that that person's never going to commit a crime again. And by putting your name on that, it's like, I feel like I'm making a deal with other parents and in the community that, okay, your child's going to be safe around this person. And I can't guarantee that. I mean, there's no 100% in that situation, but the rules say that if there's a certain percentage of recidivism within the first year, all the way out to 7 years, and they meet the minimum cutoff, I have to sign off on them saying they're safe according to the rules. And I don't necessarily want to put that person back out in the community with a statement from a psychologist, the mental health professional, saying they're safe, but the law is there.
Yeah.
And they're, you know, you know, it's there for a reason. We're trying to protect the population, and these people have already done their time. So are we in effect becoming, you know, the judge and jury all over again for a crime they've already been convicted of and done their time? And now I'm having to sign off on this, and it's a struggle. And unfortunately, like I said, sometimes, you know, we have to follow the numbers and say what, you know, the emotional, irrationally driven, you know, human side of me says, don't do this. Or wouldn't it be nice just to make this family all come back together again and be a happy family? And that's not always what the numbers say. And I can't go by my emotions when I'm sitting in front of a judge. I have to go by what the data says.
That's got to be hard. And, I'm glad you're talking about this because, as a child, I was sexually abused for years and years and years. And I just know how much it messed me up. It made me insecure. And it took many years to become secure, confident, empowered. So I love what you're doing. Let's talk about childhood resiliency. Okay. Some people will argue that bullying or somebody being harmed, even a child, can help them become stronger or more resilient. What do you think about that, Dr. John?
Well, I think with the right child it can, but with the wrong child it can make them spiral down and basically, flounder the rest of their lives. So it depends upon each individual child, and that's where you need to get therapists and counselors involved who know how to work with different individuals and know how to not put their own presses and needs on these children. Learn how to identify what each child needs, regardless of what their parents want them to have happen, what a judge wants them to have happen, and that kind of type of stuff, and be there for the kid. And I think if you can find a good therapist like that, the child is gonna thrive, period.
Yeah, because I've seen many cases, where people never got help because they were embarrassed or, they thought they the stigma or something like that. I mean, but there are good therapists out there, definitely. Now, recently, well, very recently, you were called to go down to the Parkland shooting incident. Can we talk about that?
Well, I didn't actually go to the Parkland shooting incident, but I was a school psychologist in Miami-Dade County, about 30, 45 minutes from that school. And I worked in actually their alternative education, which in Florida, or at least in Miami-Dade County, involves the kids who have committed some sort of crime and have gone through some sort of probation or incarceration. But it also includes the charter schools that are specialized to work with specific populations. So it's not all, that criminal element, but it all encompasses the mental health side of it, all of the people I was involved with. So I've also gone through that process where they Baker acted an individual and how difficult it is to get an adolescent or a minor into their mental health system against their will, against parents' wills in certain cases. And it is a difficult process, and there's nothing simple about it, and rightfully so. I don't want somebody to just be able to take any kid and, hey, we're going to go skiing this Christmas and little Billy has some behavioral problems. Let's go get him at Baker acted into the hospital for a week while the rest of the family goes snow skiing. And that's just not right. I want it to be a difficult process, but it also needs to be in such a way that it's not so difficult that nobody wants to do it, because it is time consuming. The last individual that I helped get Baker acted was a young man who was very suicidal, but he was also homicidal. He brought a gun to school and he wanted to harm his father before he harmed himself. And he went through this whole story about why and all this kind of stuff with me. That's really not the point. But to Baker Act in Florida, I needed then a police officer to come along and help me finish the process. And it basically, that's what the police officer is going to do the rest of the day. If they had other cases they were working on, if they were, if they needed to go do, so many hours of, say, highway patrol or anything, that's done. They're not going to get to do that because the Baker acting is so time consuming. So when we called and asked for the police to show up, nobody showed up. And we sat there for about an hour and a half. And then the principal of the school was very fed up. And this kid was, I mean, he's crying. He was a huge kid. He's like a sophomore and he was 6'4", 6'5". Just this monster looking of a kid, but a kid who was very emotionally damaged, and asking for help is really what he wanted. He didn't really want to harm anybody, but that nobody had heeded the call before, so he took it to this next level, and he was a perfect case for a Baker Act, where he could go get hospitalized, get the care he needed, the medication, the therapy, intensive therapy this kid needed, and get on with his life. So we're sitting there, and now it's, you know, 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and I've been involved in the case since about 8:30, 9 o'clock in the morning. And the principal walks in. He's very frustrated that, you know, that his student is still not getting the help he needs. And none of the police, you know, we called multiple times and none of the police were showing up to help us finish the case out. So the principal, believe it or not, actually called 911, said, "This is Principal so-and-so, and here's my school." And, "Oh, my God, he has a gun," and he slammed down the phone. We had about 12 cop cars there in about 35, 40 seconds. It was amazing.
That is amazing. I mean, if that's what it takes to help somebody, that is amazing, thinking outside the box. Good for him.
Good for him. And, you know, and of course, all the cops walked in and said, "Why are we here?" And, well, this kid needs Baker acted, and he had a gun. So the principal did not lie. And they're like, "Oh, well," so they walked over to the kid and they go, "So if I give you your gun, you're going to shoot yourself right now." Totally not getting the point that he wanted to harm his father first, you know? And so the kid's like, "No, I wouldn't do that. You don't." And the cop said, "See, he's not." And I go, whoa, wait a minute. You can't, you're going to say, you know, your years on the police force catching criminals is something that I could never do and I'm not trained to do, and you're going to come to me with my decade or more of mental health training and experience and working with suicidal people, and you're going to say that I don't know what I'm talking about. And you know, and the kid's like looking at me like, "Yes, listen to this guy." And so I had to tell this officer the whole situation, at which point the officer, you know, grudgingly, but did follow through and get the young man Baker acted at that point. But it was pulling teeth. And when they say, "Well, why didn't the Parkland shooter, why didn't he, you know, have all this intervention? He had all these, you know, visits from the police and all this." It's a time consuming process. The you know, the world is asking these police officers to essentially become therapists or psychologists and make a determination before they actually take them to the psychologist and psychiatrist and therapist at the state facility to do this process. And there is a lack of a training, a lack of support. Mm-hmm. And then this whole, you know, we started talking about it a second ago, the stigma, you know, that somehow, if we do this to the kid is somehow broken and the world will never see this individual as anything but broken. And the reality of it is a human process to have emotional and mental health issues. It's not a crazy issue. It's not a bizarre thing. Every one of us at some point in our life experiences, for example, grief and loss. We lose a pet, and later on in life we lose a family member, maybe a parent, a sibling, a cousin, a grandparent, and we go through this. So we all have a little bit of flavor of what that is. Some people, however, don't have the coping skills for whatever reason, a biochemical reason, an environmental reason, a cognitive reason, that can't allow them to get through that process for several days, weeks, sometimes even several years. And they deserve to get help just like somebody who's suffering from the flu or leukemia or anything else like that. And we, because of the fear of the stigma, we don't do it. We don't give them what they need to help a fellow human being.
Yeah. And I'm going to a mental health conference with our producer, Kristen Walker, and Melanie Van this month. And it's a big conference, and I know you know about it, Dr. John, with all these mental health professionals. And I know one of the speakers there is one of the only survivors that jumped off the Golden Bridge, you know, and survived. And he's talking about it today. So the thing is, I think so many people have stigma about mental health issues. And I know 5 years ago, I became a government whistleblower after 18 months of fighting on my own, losing my home, losing my livelihood. You know, I passed out. I ended up in the mental health ward. I was not Baker-vacked. I chose to be there because I was so exhausted and I was depressed and I had the victimhood. But that's actually where I had my transformation. 3 days later, when they said, "Do you want a shower?" And I'm like, "Oh my God, yes." And I'm looking in the mirror and I didn't even recognize myself, Dr. John. I see, you know, I'm very fair skinned. I grew up in Florida, you know, and I'm very, very light skinned. And I'm looking at myself, my skin looks yellow and my eyes underneath have purple, you know. And I'm, "Who the heck are you? Who the heck are you?" And I kind of had a hate fest with myself at that time. And I said, you know, why did you allow yourself to become a victim? Why did you allow yourself to break? But I don't care how strong you think you are. I mean, I spent 20 years in the Air Force with a bunch of men. You know, I grew up with seven brothers and stepbrothers, a total of seven. And I'm a very strong person. Everybody can break. So I'm so glad you talked about stigma and the right, you know, people deserve to get the help they get. And that's where I had my transformation. And I'm not ashamed of it. In fact, I talk about it quite regularly.
Well, you know, and it's interesting you say that. One of the things when I was teaching regularly at the university and, you know, over 20 some odd years, I would take my students to the state hospital. And I would have students come up to me and go, "Why are you know, it's not a zoo. Why are you, you know, taking us there?" You know, because they had a family member who may have been hospitalized at some point, or maybe themselves had been hospitalized. And the interesting thing was, you know, I would talk with them and I would talk about the whole idea that I'm trying to get across is that if all the dominoes line up in your life, you could end up there, period. And that it's not that hard to have that happen. And the amazing thing was I never had one of these students or sometimes their parents who complained before the event. When I brought them in with us after the event, they were apologizing and thanking me for taking them there because it was not a zoo. Mm-hmm. In fact, the state hospital, because they had known me and I'd worked there and things like that, they would bring the patients in and, you know, we would interact with the patients. We would have, you know, we'd play games, board games, draw, do different type of art projects. We would do things like for Valentine's Day. We would do things for, you know, Halloween, depending upon what time of the year we were going in there. And halfway through just about every event, you know, I would have one of the assistants who works at the hospital come up to me. "Now, is that a patient or is that one of your students?" Because,
oh wow.
Because not because they were acting crazy, but yeah, because everybody's acting normal.
Right.
Because we made it a normal situation and it was very difficult to see. You couldn't just sit there and look at most of the patients and say, "Are you sure they're not one of your students or my students?" And think, "Are you sure they're not one of our patients?" Because yeah, everybody was acting human.
Right.
You know,
right.
There was none of this, none of these bizarre expectations. Now, occasionally, you know, I think in the 16, 17 years of me bringing students in there, I think I had two or three situations over that whole time bringing, you know, usually two visits a semester. So, you know, pushing 60 trips with anywhere from 10 to 55 or 60 students at a time. I think there were two or three events where I had a patient who, because of their mental health issues, became either erratic or violent, and it was never at any of the students, not one time. I had one, I was helping and I brought him out a tray of food and he saw me and immediately took a swing at me. At that point I was already a black belt. So I immediately dodged and kind of moved to the side. He misses me. He hits the tray of food and there's food all over the ceiling all of a sudden.
Oh my.
And it was almost before the tray hit the ground that the psych techs and everybody stepped over and just calmly brought the gentleman away from the event and took him down to the outdoor general area and let him walk off whatever was irritating him at that point. And in fact, because it all happened so quickly and so smoothly, afterwards I asked my students, you know, if they saw what happened, and only one student out of 40 saw anything. So my students never and that whole time ever felt threatened or endangered in any way, shape, or form. And, you know, it's funny in college because we get students who come in there as freshmen that are 16 years old. Mm-hmm. You know, I have one, she, you know, decades later, she still stays in contact with me. She was 16 years old in my class. And, she had actually gone through legally become emancipated as an adult, because when she came in and she's 16, I'm like, okay, I need signed consent. You know, you guys have to sign off on this stuff. And she pulls out her driver's license and says she's 16. And I'm like, wait a minute, I have to get a legal guardian to sign this. And she pulled out these court documents that said, no, she is.
That's unreal. That is unreal.
And yeah. And so it was like, wow, you know, I'd never dealt with that side of it. Cause usually when I'm involved in court, it's not a good thing. And this person was just so, you know, she graduated high school at 15 years old and just way ahead of her developmental time, and an amazing person. And she's still out there and she's doing her own interventions and stuff now. Actually, she's some kind of yogi master and stuff, and she does all this yoga stuff and just an amazing young person. But you get that all the way up to a 62, 60, you know, 7-year-old college student who's, after retiring and working, you know, building houses or whatever their whole life, decided it was time they got an education. Mm-hmm. And, the population is such an amazing group when you get into college. And the fear factor of going into a state mental hospital. I mean, I actually had patients, students who would come in and they were like, well, what if they don't let me out? I'm like, wait a minute.
That's funny.
You watch too many movies and seen too many TV shows.
Dr. John, I have to tell you that the third day in the mental health for myself, when I looked in the metal mirror, you know, I got it together. I'm like, okay, I'm not going to be a victim anymore. I had the transformation in the mental health ward. So I said, hey, let's have an interdisciplinary meeting. And you know what that is. And so they're all asking me questions and stuff like that. And they're like, you really are good. And I'm like, I told you I was good. I've never been suicidal. I was just tired, exhausted. And I had a little bit of the victimhood. And I know one of the psychiatrists said, you know, some of the things that happened to you, other people would have committed suicide, you know. And I said, well, I know we're all unique and different, but yeah, I mean, they didn't hesitate. They're like, you are good. We'll let you out. And I'm like, thank you.
Well, you know, and
after that, everything was great.
And you mentioned that keyword resilience, you know, and people often think, okay, so the opposite of depression is, you know, being well. And I'm like, actually, I believe it's resilience. It's being able to deal with life in general, and sometimes very specific, but all the traumas, the everyday things that roll across our front door every single day, and move forward, and being resilient, being able to overcome and deal with each individual thing. And that's why I said earlier, if all the dominoes line up just right, anybody can end up in a state mental health facility.
Absolutely. And I was actually in a VA hospital because I'm retired Air Force, but it's all the same.
Awesome.
So I know you have dealt with such heinous crimes. You've seen so much. How do you keep balance? How do you keep from going nuts?
Well, one of the things... I have a core group of very amazing people around me, first of all, and you know, I learned to use them, and it's very difficult. You know, we're taught in society to be tough and independent, and that works for a little while, and then your walls start tearing down. And so I have an amazing group of peers that I work with, family members that I communicate with, and I do a lot of taking care of myself. You know, I try to eat right. I don't go for one annual physical every year. I get two, because about every 6 months, I want my doctor to check, and I want the numbers to support what's going on to see if I am moving forward and I'm not progressing in a bad way, because stress shows up physically in your medical charts. It's really easy to see that after you've been working in that area. The other thing I do is I see a varied population of patients. I don't, like I said before, I don't always do child custody cases. They're very traumatic. They're very trying. And, you know, you have to learn to compartmentalize. But then I have patients in my office who are dealing with everyday, you know, just I need help getting through today. It was a tough week, you know.
Sure.
My kids are sick, and I how did I balance work and taking care of my kids and feeling guilty? Maybe I need to take more time with my kids, or feeling guilty at work. And then I go into court and I check out people that are struggling and need some kind of competency evaluation, because, you know, maybe the courts are going after this person because they're not a mental health facility. They're a punishment organization. They're there to punish people for not following the rules of society. But if you are, for example, mentally ill with something like schizophrenia, or you have just in general reality testing issues, you may not understand why people are mad at you or upset at you and charging you with these crimes. And, you know, if that's the case, you don't really need to be in jail or prison. You need to be in a mental health facility trying to recoup or get those skills necessary to have better reality testing, have better coping mechanisms, so you don't end up back in the system. And, you know, over the years, I've developed a core group of attorneys who are actually there because they're trying to help their patients, their clients, sorry. And you know, they never put expectations on me. When I go and I get a call from them, hey, I need you to go and work with this person. Here's the letter so you can get into jail, or I'll have this client call you and set up an interview. And they're just like, give me whatever you find out. I'll deal with it. Versus attorneys who called me in the past said, hey, can you work on this case? I'm trying to defend this guy. And I'm like, sure, okay. And then after we agree, then all of a sudden they start pressuring, well, you're going to find this with this patient, right? Mm-hmm. And I never work with those attorneys again, because I can't say what I'm going to find until after I actually test and evaluate the individual. So for them to try to get me to, you know, have a preconceived idea of what I'm going to find and just find that because this attorney thinks it'll help defend that client, I think that's unethical at the very least. And I don't play those games. And sometimes it makes it hard for me to, you know, get paid by those attorneys. So I do like they do. I asked for a retainer. I said, I need a retainer of X amount of dollars if you want me to work on this case.
Yep. 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 I don't blame
And it's tough. And so I go from that back to, you know, my old work as a school psychologist. I get a lot of kids whose parents are not happy with what's going on in the school. Because of that, they don't trust the school psychologist in their local community, which, by the way, 99% of those school psychologists are amazing people and do an amazing job. The only thing is that they're bound by another set of laws instead of just state rules to deal with mental health issues. They also are dealing with federal rules and laws that apply specifically to public education. So they may not always approach things or present things the way someone in independent practice can do. And I explain that to parents. And a lot of times, you know, the parents, after talking with me, are much more at ease in letting the school proceed with their own practitioners. It saves them money. It saves the school system. Doesn't then have to go back through and sit down with me and take my evaluation and try to modify it so it fits the academic world. So, I mean, I face all these different types of stressors. And one of the things that I do is plug them in and unplug them as I go, not even through the week, but sometimes through the day. And that allows me to go, and if I'm dealing at the hospital with someone who, for example, last week I was asked to talk to two patients who the doctors and the medical teams believe that there's nothing left they can do with these patients. Mm-hmm. And they wanted me to go in and talk to the patients about palliative care and or hospice type of care so that they can quit struggling the last few weeks, sometimes hours, but in this case, weeks of life, and actually be present for their family and friends and kind of tie up the end of life and have some kind of dignity as they process through to the end of their life. And it always amazes me. Probably 99.9% of the patients, they already knew before I walked in the door and sit down and tell them. It's the family, it's the friends, and they lose it.
Yeah. Oh, I get it.
And it's like I can remember to this day, the very first time that I did an evaluation, and I was the first person to identify this person as, back in the day, mentally retarded. And I mean, I was so concerned. I was so afraid, you know, that, you know, I was a young psychologist and, you know, the whole family's going to come after me. They're going to hate me. And, you know, I'm like, ugh, you know, I don't want to tell them at the school meeting when there's 10 or 12 people that they don't know. And then I sit down with them and in front of everybody introduce this to them for the first time. So I arranged a meeting with the family and we went down to the local library because I wanted people present. And we sat down in one of the little study rooms and I pull out all my data and all the stuff. And I go through the whole thing, and then finally I said, so basically what I'm trying to say is your child has a diagnosis of mild mental retardation. And the looks on the family's face were just amazing. They were like, finally, somebody said it.
Yeah.
You know, they're like, we knew. We just, you know, we couldn't access any services from the state, from the community, through their insurance company until somebody made the diagnosis.
Exactly.
And
yes.
all of a sudden, all this help was available to this family, and they knew it. And they knew this was what was wrong with their child. Aww. Nobody had ever formally said it. And they were so ecstatic and happy. And we got to the school meeting a couple days later, and they made me feel like I was just a godsend. And it was, you know, I'm like, wait a minute, this meeting's about your kiddo. Let's see what we can do to help your kiddo. I appreciate the affirmations and everything, but the reality of it is that's why I'm here, is for the kids.
And it's very satisfying when you're helping people. And I know, because you deal with so many stressful things, I know you're a stand-up comic. Talk about that real quickly.
Well, you know,
I want to talk about that.
through teaching at the university and dealing with kids, really, my whole professional life, I learned that, you know, there's ways to help people remember things. And if we can attach emotion to topics and ideas, people learn them much better, much more easily, more efficiently. So I can sit there and make people angry at me and they'll remember the topic. And I'm like, that's not what I want to do. Yeah. So I started off taking my experience with the little kiddos and stuff and how, you know, they would let me do therapy if I was playing Cowboys and Indians with them. Aww. So, you know, we would be hiding behind the desk and this kid is telling me about all this trauma and stuff they've experienced. And, you know, I walk out of this room and give reports to people like, how did you find all this stuff out? He never says anything to me. And I go, well, I got down on the floor and I crawled around on my knees and I ducked my head around corners. And whenever I would catch him, the deal was he would tell me an answer. He would give me information. So
my goodness, that's so different.
So I started taking all of this life experience and, you know, thinking how amazing these stories are, and in retrospect, very funny. And I learned so much, not only about my clients, but about me. So when I would walk into the classroom, I quit regurgitating what was specifically in the textbook and started saying, okay, so here's this topic. You guys need to read this. This is the basic parts of it. And this is why it's so important for me as a psychologist to know that. And I would relate real life cases to each one of those things. And I would tell the funny stories. And I, all of a sudden, my classes went from 30 to 80 to, okay, you know, the fire marshal's getting mad at you because this is a 70 seat classroom and we've got 115 people in your class. So they moved me to the lecture halls. All of a sudden, I've got 400 or 500 students in my class, and I'm teaching, you know, 1500 to 1800 students a semester. And, you know, it was because I made all this psychobabble, and then I would take it and put it in real life experience, which actually helped me much more in the courtroom, because when I have a jury sitting there and they ask, you know, the attorney asked me a question, and I can give them the psychobabble, but nobody in the jury understands that. But nobody's going to say, I don't get it. I don't know what you're talking about. So I relate it and make it a real life situation. If this happens, this happens, this happens, and this is what we expect. But in this case, this happened because he doesn't have this reality testing ability. And all of a sudden, my juries understand it, and they don't feel like I'm talking down to them. Uh-huh. And, you know, I don't use as much, if at all, any humor in the courtroom. That, you know, the judges don't tend to like that. But occasionally, it's very appropriate and poignant. And I've done it. And then I started my nonprofit. Okay. My nonprofit is to try and destigmatize mental health.
Oh,
and I've been working
that.
On that. It's mainstreammentalhealth.org. And my goal is to make mental health mainstream, that anybody can talk about it anywhere with anybody and not feel like somehow they're broken or they're not a good person, and no shame. So that's my goal. And I do that through education. And we do, as you know, I have my podcast and I do multiple interviews with my experience. For example, we just had the Austin bomber. I did multi interviews there, nationwide radio interviews, statewide television, nationwide television, and talking about what, you know, happens in these types of cases, how they do some of the investigation and what to expect, what, you know, making predictions on who the perpetrator was based on profiling techniques and things like that. And, you know, that's always kind of a scary thing, because you go out and you make these profile based off data, mm-hmm. not necessarily off that case. And we know that no profiling has ever directly led to the arrest and conviction of anyone. So it's just a helpful organization skill that police departments sometimes utilize to help focus their attention. And it was crazy, because I did this in a statewide, you know, television show 4 different times, 2 on one day and then 2 following days after that. And after the Austin bomber got caught, I actually got called by friends of the family, mm-hmm. who called me at the end of the week, Friday afternoon, and they were asking me about, you know, well, when you interviewed the mom and all this kind of stuff. And I go, I never interviewed the mom. And they're like, well, how did you know what was going on in the family? How did you know that this was his personality? And it's, you know, that's what I do. And I was kind of lucky. I was on a radio station, and I said, okay, they found the Rosetta Stone when they got a bomb that hadn't exploded. Mm-hmm. And I predicted that it would be a very short amount of time that they catch this guy. And the radio station was in Dallas, and they're like, oh, well, weeks. And I go, no, hours. And they started laughing at me. And so one of the guys stopped, and he goes, so is this guy going to go peaceably? And I go, no, he's going to go out with a bang. And of course, 2 o'clock the next morning, that happened. They actually called me, had me come back on the radio and apologize for laughing at me, because I did call it, and they were amazed. And I just used that as a humor kind of situation. I said, look, you know, I didn't expect you guys to believe me, but, you know, and I could have been completely wrong, but based on my experience, what I know about how amazing our FBI bomb people are, mm-hmm. That this was this was the Rosetta Stone. It was going to tell them almost where the guy lived, if not, you know, it actually did. And that was pretty crazy. And so I take all these life experiences and I bring them together. And through mainstream mental health, I try to destigmatize mental health issues. And so last year we had a huge contest here in the state of Texas called Texas Funniest News Reporter. So I got all these news reporters across the state and I invited them to come to Austin, and they had one night to do their stand up. And we had actual comedians in the audience who were judges. We had actually one of my board members from my nonprofit was a judge. And then my PR firm out of New York, two of them came down, Ryan and Mark, and they came in and they were judges. And I abstained from judging because, man, everybody was funny. And so I'm up there and I introduce everybody, but of course I have to do my little spiel and I go through. And so every time I go up there, I'm doing my little thing, but I shared the stage with a real life comedian, Julie McCullough, who is also a Playboy playmate. And she goes around and does comedy now, and just an amazing person. And so I started off the show, and then she did the next introduction. Then I did the next introduction. And each time I would do a few minutes of my stand-up that I learned over the years. And I would relate that to specific mental health things and talk about how mental health is part of everybody's life. And we were able to then, you know, do the destigmatization talk and make it fun, make it enlightening. And we actually found out who Texas's funniest comedian is. Now part of Texas funniest news reporter comedian and there are rules, you know, people don't realize that when you do stand up that you get like 5 minutes. And if you're not finished in 5 minutes, the house turns the mic off.
Oh my goodness. Oh.
So you're done. So some of these reporters, we weren't being rude to them like that. And they, you know, they lost points because they went 12 minutes or 20 minutes in one case.
Oh, good.
And they were extremely funny, but they didn't follow the rules. And the comedians, the real professional comedians, were just so livid. Mm. Like, wait, they don't know the name of this game. We don't have a half hour to get people to laugh. We have to do it in 5 minutes or less. So they were cutting people off on their points, not actually with the mic. So at the end of the night, we raised a good amount of money. Actually, that was our biggest fundraiser. We're doing it again this year. It's going to be in September. We're still negotiating with the comedy club to get it all set up. We sold the venue out. They turned away 40 some odd people because of fire marshal rules. They can't let them in at that point. But at the end of the night, everything was said and done. The place was, you know, clearing out, and lo and behold, Rob Reiner came in and had watched the whole show. When his wife came in, sat on, got a table. When the lights went down, he came into the club and actually went and sat with his wife and was there for the whole show. And it was such an amazing thrill. I mean, the guy stood up and, you know, congratulated me, told me how wonderful the event was, how funny I was, not just the actual reporters, and how, you know, it's doing a good thing trying to draw attention to mental health. And man, that was just amazing. And if I'd have been thinking quickly on my feet at that point, I was just so overwhelmed with, I mean, it took us 6 months to get this thing produced. I should have invited him on my radio show. I probably could have got a commitment, but it was just wow. You know, I was floored. The guy, you know, Rob Reiner told me I was funny. Meathead from All in the Family. I'm funny.
That's great.
Wow, that was a trip.
Yeah, and you do. So, that's great.
I use it as a vent.
Yeah, and we have to wrap up. This is so hard. We have to wrap up. We're having such a good time. You're so funny, and it's been great even being able to laugh about me being in the mental health ward in a good way, in a healthy way. So,
yes,
Dr.
Yes.
Dunn, how can people get a hold of you? Because I know you are in demand. You are all over the nation. You're on radio all the time, TV. You're doing all these different, your work and stuff. You're very busy. If somebody wants to get a hold of you, what is the best way to reach out to you?
The best way is to start our website, mainstreammentalhealth.org. You can email us at mainstreammentalhealth@gmail.com. Go to, guess where, the mental health News Radio Network and check out my blog. We always talk about ways to get all of us there. So if you, you know, forget my email address or anything else like that, check out the Mental Health News Radio Network. It's a great place. And there's a lot of great talent on there, Dawn included. And everybody has a different experience.
Yes.
And Dawn focuses on bullying. I just kind of do a general caveat. I mean, I've done a lot of things in my life professionally, and everywhere I've gone, we have to fight stigma of mental health. So that's
absolutely
my goal. I will
absolutely
talk about anything related to mental health. So
perfect. Well, thank you again, Dr. John, for being on my show. I'm glad you're one of the peer podcasters with me. And I want to give a shout out to Kristen Walker, who started Mental Health News Radio. We are underneath her. It's such an awesome opportunity to work together and to talk to you today. To our listeners, always know that there's solutions and you can be empowered. And today's lesson, or what we've heard today, is you don't have to have stigma around mental health issues. If you need help, get help. If you need to be in the mental health ward to get better, do it. Everyone have a great day and stay empowered.
Thank you for listening to the Empowered Whistleblower. As your host, I will continue to bring in the best experts to share their knowledge and empower our listeners. Nobody has to feel like a victim. There are solutions to bullying and discrimination. Everyone deserves to be treated with respect and dignity. All our future shows will offer practical guidance so that anyone can choose to stand up to bullying and discrimination. You deserve to be happy, and life is all about choices. I always welcome comments and suggestions for new shows. Please comment and share your ideas, and be sure to come back for more inspiration and empowerment. I am Dawn Marie Westmoreland signing off and wishing you much happiness and empowerment in your day.